be reality, not illusion or delusion that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Dr. Garth Nicholson, who is formerly, held to two tenured professor's positions at the MD Anderson Clinic in Texas, Houston, Texas, and held the university appointments, taught in the medical school there, was on the board of directors, the editorial board of a number of scientific magazines, and edited several scientific magazines of his own. But he has the most amazing story to tell about how he was forced to leave where he was because of the assassination and murder of the man who was his direct superior, who was going to come forward and tell the truth about... Well, I'm going to let him tell you those stories. Dr. Nicholson, thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on your show again.
And, of course, Dr. Nicholson has written a wonderful book. It's called Project Daylily, which we carry, and when people hear what's in this story, although it's written from a fiction, it's written on based upon fact, but it's written as fiction because, of course, really to prevent lawsuits from coming about. But I certainly, as I read this book, I know who just about all the people there. Many of them I've actually interviewed, people who've been trying to get the truth out about some of the terrible experiments that have been carried out that have destroyed the lives of so many people in our country. So you pick up the story there, Dr. Nicholson. You probably, like most people, had no idea what was really going on in America when you were, you know, taking your years of study and university, and even when you first got your university appointment. Did you have any idea what was really going on?
Well, I had some idea that people were being used as guinea pigs, but I had absolutely no idea that they were being used without full informed consent or without their knowledge. And this is a tragedy that has taken place in America. It's really a product of the Cold War, and it's Cold War thinking is really what it is, because we got involved after the first Gulf War. Our stepdaughter served in the first Gulf War. She was a decorated soldier. She served on a Black Hawk helicopter and was on the deep insertions into Iraq. And when she came home, she was training to be a pilot, was planning a career in the Army, and her health started to fail. And we would get calls from her, so we kind of knew what was going on. And we had no idea at the time that they were trying to diagnose all these veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, essentially a psychosomatic illness or psychological illness, and we knew that that wasn't in the case for her, and she indicated it was not the case for colleagues as well. They had real illnesses, they had real medical problems, and so these problems kind of look like things like chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia syndrome, which are now just exploding in incidence in the United States. And when we first started studying this, we had no idea what we were getting into.
All right, fine. Well, we'll be back in just a moment as we bring some of our other stations on board. But our guest is Dr. Garth Nicholson, who has been studying really since the early 1990s or mid-1990s this entity called Gulf War illness. And then as you begin studying this more and more, you find out we have all sorts of new diseases in America. We have Lyme disease. Where did Lyme disease come from? 1 million Americans are afflicted with it. 2 million Americans with chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia combined. Where are these diseases coming from? And what is Gulf War illness? Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. I guess this afternoon is one of my favorite guests, Dr. Garth Nicholson, who, of course, is one of the world's leading biologists and researchers in certainly in disease processes, and he held a professorship, tenured professorship at the MB Anderson Clinic in Houston, Texas. But he was just saying that he really did not get started really studying these things until after the first Gulf War, when his stepdaughter came home. And of course she was seriously ill with this, she was totally incapacitated. The Army kept insisting, oh, it's just post-traumatic stress. But you're dealing with literally hundreds of thousands of people, and this is not simply post-traumatic stress. There are a very definite set of symptoms, physical symptoms, not psychological symptoms. So pick up the story there, Dr. Nicholson.
Well, it turned out the story was much more complex than we thought. But when we started to work on these illnesses, mainly with the Special Forces units and the airborne units, because we had the most contact with these units, we were finding a wide variety of different problems. So it wasn't just one sort of thing that might cause this. There were multiple agents and multiple environmental exposures that were involved. And this has kind of complicated the whole issue, because there just isn't one simple cause for these illnesses. But that's true for most chronic illnesses. It turns out, there are millions and millions of people that are sick in the United States with various chronic illnesses. These can be autoimmune illnesses, for example, like rheumatic diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, sarcoidosis, and a variety of other rheumatic illnesses. These could be fatiguing illnesses like Gulf War illness, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia syndrome. These could be gastrointestinal problems like inflammatory bowel diseases, for example, and a number of other conditions like that. These could actually be coronary problems caused by vasculitis or an inflammation of the vascular system, causing increased blood clotting and heart problems and so on. All these different illnesses and a variety of neurologic illnesses, particularly neurologic autoimmune illnesses, and some that we're working on now, childhood diseases like autism, for example, and attention deficit disorder. Many of these diseases had as an important either cause or cofactor in the illness chronic infections. And we had no idea of this before. In fact, most people have no idea of this now. But we stumbled across this, and we found in Gulf War that 40% of the veterans that were sick had this unusual infection called Mycoplasma fermentans. And as soon as we mentioned that word, our lives changed forever.
Oh, you hang on to that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment, right here at the Genesis Radio Network. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Nicholson was just saying that everything was going along until suddenly they began to recognize that many of the people, victims of the Gulf War illness, and people with chronic fatigue syndrome had an infection with a Mycoplasma fermentans, which most people have never heard. Could you explain to our listeners what the mycoplasma is and why you came under such tremendous pressure when you exposed the fact that many of our veterans and many of the people all across America, and we're talking probably in the neighborhood of at least 2 million people, you correct me if I'm wrong on that, but the figure I've read about 800,000 chronic fatigue, and almost with added fibromyalgia, maybe 2 million Americans, more or less totally disabled, or many of them totally disabled, had many of these people, a significant number of them, have this Mycoplasma fermentans. Why was that important?
Well, it turns out it was important because the U.S. Army had actually patented the detection of this microbe, and they were well aware of its properties. They were well aware that it could cause diseases like this. In fact, we found out later they even had publications showing that it could be a lethal infection, and Armed Forces personnel that they had infected purposely with this often had gone on and progressed and actually died from the infection. So we knew that it was potentially dangerous, and along the way, there are something like 28 or 30,000 Gulf War veterans that have died because of illnesses that they contracted because of the conflict. So we're not talking about something that's trivial. We're talking about something that can be potentially fatal. And often I'm asked, well, these fatiguing illnesses, for example, these autoimmune illnesses, these aren't fatal, are they? Well, they shouldn't be, and, traditionally they haven't been. But unfortunately, if you get one of these unusual infections, and I mean unusual because they have unusual genes associated with them that shouldn't be there, or unusual modifications, they can be very dangerous, and they can ultimately progress to a lethality. So we're dealing with things that shouldn't be lethal, but unfortunately, if you get the right infection along with these conditions, it can be a lethal disease. So it's something that we can't trivialize, we can't ignore. We have to do something about it. And as we started to spread the information and started to speak out on the results, our world changed completely. They went after us big time, and they tried to do everything possible. When I mean they, that's the book will tell the story about what happened to us and how we escaped from being murdered, for example, how we escaped from being economically destroyed, our careers were ruined, and our whole lives just simply fell apart because of trying to get the information out about these diseases and the role of these unusual infections in these diseases.
Well, of course, the contention is that these have actually been modified to become biological warfare agents. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, I think that's a fair statement, because what we found was, and this the book Project Daylily goes into this, is that before the Gulf War, these weapons, as we call them, were being tested in the prison system, and they were being tested on military recruits. And this is one reason why we got so much trouble in Texas, because, in fact, some of these weapons were being tested in the prison system, but they weren't being tested with full informed consent. There were many prisoners that were getting sick and dying, and they were being secretly, their bodies were being carried away and autopsied at Army bases, and then they were being secretly cremated, and their records were being destroyed. And all this was happening, and nobody knew anything about it, really. We were just in academia, sequestered away from this, but we kept being slapped in the face by this. People kept showing up at our doorstep that were ill. We had prison guards and their family members who were ill, many of them with autoimmune diseases, with fatiguing illnesses, with all these unusual problems. And when we started testing them, they started coming up positive for some of these unusual infections.
And, of course, the thing is that this was a place called Huntsville, Texas, where they had actually decided to do these experiments without the knowledge of the people, of the prisoners. But then, of course, the disease got from the prisoners into the guards, from the guards into their families. And you had an epidemic of MS and anterior lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease, didn't you?
Oh, yes. In Huntsville alone, there were some 40 or 50 cases of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. And this should have an incidence of about 1 in 100,000, and that's a little town of about 30,000. It just so happens there are three prisons located near that town. In fact, we just got a telephone call today from a lady who actually organized the support group of the prison guards. Turns out her husband was the assistant warden of the Walls unit there, and that's the condemned prisoner unit in Huntsville. Huntsville is where they take the condemned prisoners in the state of Texas for housing and eventual execution. And they had tremendous problems, not only in that unit, but in all the prisons in that area. And, of course, that was the principal employer of this small town, that is the prison system in Texas. And so the people from the prison system were going home and bringing these infections home to family members. So we had entire families that were sick, and her family was one of them. And her daughter, who was aged about 18 at the time, was diagnosed with ALS, and they gave her a very poor prognosis. They said she'd be dead within 2 years, and she's now fully recovered and has had two very healthy babies and has gone on to lead a normal life. But if we weren't around, I don't think she would be around.
And, of course, this was the thing. The fact that you were, first of all, found out what was happening, and the second that you put a lot of these people under treatment, this got you into real trouble, because, after all, the last thing they wanted is for the American people to find out that they are violating the laws. This is the sort of thing that they would have done in Hitler's Germany. In fact, didn't a lot of this start in Hitler's Germany and come to America with many of the German Nazi scientists we brought here under Operation Paperclip?
That's exactly right. In fact, we were trying to trace back the origin of the infection that we found, and turns out the Army brought this back from Germany after World War II as a part of Operation Paperclip, along with some of the scientists that they recruited. And, you know, you hear a lot about rocket scientists like Wernher von Braun, but you don't hear anything about the chemical and biological warfare experts that were brought back from Germany after World War II. These people went into our federal system of research, for example, run by the Army and other agencies of the U.S. government, where they could continue their work. And that happened during the Cold War era, when we thought it was necessary to employ these people to keep them from the Russians and to keep ahead of the Russians. And the Russians were heavily engaged in other countries like Korea, North Korea, and so on, were heavily engaged in this type of research. So I think we felt it was perfectly okay to do this at the time. But it wasn't. It wasn't okay because we put so many people at risk. These were innocent Americans that were placed at risk because of these experiments. And I think these are Nazi-era experiments that were continued. That's my opinion on it.
And, of course, the thing is that this then got from Huntsville all across America, and probably not only from Huntsville, but other areas where they probably introduced these infections in the population. And we find now, is that figure 2 million Americans, is that high for chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia together, or is that low?
Now it's low, and if you start considering the autoimmune diseases, the neurologic diseases, the numbers are way low. It's several times that, at least. You know, it just one aspect of this that we stumbled across, and I'll mention this because I have to go to a meeting fairly shortly. We were looking at the families of the Gulf War veterans that came back. And after the Gulf War, when the veteran came home, illnesses propped up in the families, just as the veterans were becoming sick. The family members were also becoming sick because these infections are airborne. They'll pass from one person to another. Most of the infections that we study were not highly contagious, so they didn't show up right away. But we found that the very slowly evolving series of illnesses in the family, and the spouses were generally diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia syndrome, and they had, turns out, the same infection that we found, the mycoplasma we found in the veteran. And then the children were becoming sick. And the interesting thing about that is that often the children were diagnosed with attention deficit disorder, autism, or other what we call autistic spectrum disorders related to autism. And this turned out to be, in a way, a very interesting aspect of this whole problem, because we're now involved in studying civilian families that have autistic children, and we find not necessarily the same infection, but we find similar types of infections in the children that have autism. So it did open up a whole new area of work for us, and into diseases that the etiologies were, if not unknown, at least they only knew about the heavy metal contamination in these patients. Nobody had any idea that they also had infections as well.
You're saying the heavy metal contamination, the thimerosal and the aluminum and the other things that they were giving these children in their vaccinations, these terrible, really a totally uncalled for thing. Do you think that that played some part in predisposing them to getting these chronic infections?
I think it did. And I think it's another example of how profit over safety dictates what is done, even with our children today, because there is absolutely no reason why, for example, vaccines had to be contaminated with mercury. This is done to preserve the vaccine, to keep it from becoming contaminated. But there are other ways to do that without involving heavy metals, which are very dangerous for children. It's very dangerous to be exposed to this during their developmental stages. And it does leave them open to opportunistic infections, and that's how we think so many of these children have these infections.
Well, now, had any of the scientists that were working on these secret government projects, did any of them ever approach you? You know, because, of course, letting people know about the truth of what had happened could very well risk their lives.
Well, unfortunately, very few of them ever came forward.
Did any of them ever come forward, to your knowledge?
Only one retired colonel came forward to us, who was involved in the MK Ultra program and told us a lot about what was going on after we had essentially publicity from the work we had done. He found out about it and contacted us.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Dr. Garth Nicholson, and his book is Project Daylily. We carry the book. We think it's a fascinating book, and you'll find it fascinating as you begin to read about all these diseases that have been launched on the civilian population of America and their devastating effect. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest is Dr. Garth Nicholson. And we're talking about certainly the tragedy of really what's unfolded. And was that the colonel who was actually killed, the gentleman you were working with?
No, this was an Army colonel who had retired. And I can't really give his name.
Oh, no, I wouldn't want you to.
But he had contacted us and gave us some more information, helped us, in fact, leading us into additional directions besides just the chronic infections.
And he talked then about the chronic infections that were involved.
Well, he did say that we were on the right track, and he did give us some other information to go in other metabolic directions as well as the infections. So, well,
now, what about the relationship between certainly these chronic infections we're talking about and the acquired immunodeficiency disease, so-called AIDS? Is there any relationship to them?
Oh, absolutely. The types of infections that we have been working on, infections like mycoplasma, for example, are the true killers in HIV/AIDS. As you know, the HIV virus can cause immunosuppression, but immunosuppression alone will not lead to a fatal disease, a progressively fatal disease. It really requires other infections to cause the pathology of the disease process, or the pathogenesis of the disease, and that's what infections like the mycoplasma do. Now, interestingly enough, the mycoplasma that we've found is present probably in 60 to 80% of AIDS patients. So it's one of the major pathogenic factors in AIDS.
And isn't this the one that actually the Army had actually patented?
Yes, this is the one the Army holds the patent on, and they're still studying it and publishing on its role as a cofactor in AIDS. And so that's another interesting aspect of the studies.
And, of course, that's a little... You actually didn't get into that at all. You were primarily with these other chronic infections. I think it's so interesting that that these chronic infections can actually cause heart attacks and heart disease. Could you develop that idea just a little bit? I think this is something that the average doctor, certainly I was not aware of until I talked to you.
Well, the interesting thing about this, again, it goes back to our studies with the Gulf War veterans, where we're having a lot of heart problems and even heart attacks in this under 25 age group that was deployed to the Persian Gulf, and that just shouldn't happen in that age group. And so we knew something unusual was going on. And, of course, in every case that we looked at, these infections were involved. And when we looked at this further, it turns out these infections like the mycoplasma infection, for example, Brucella and other types of intracellular bacterial infections can invade into the blood vessels and the cells lining the blood vessels. And when this happens, these are the endothelial cells lining the blood vessels, when they get invaded by these particular bacterial infections, they are metabolically changed into a pro-inflammatory state. And in that state, they release a lot of factors which increase the clotting of the blood, and so there turns out the number of clots in the blood increases very dramatically, and the size of the clots increases, and this puts a person at risk for stroke or heart disease if the vessels of the heart are clogged by these thrombi in the blood. And so this is something that turns out is very important, and it's a process that's called vasculitis, or inflammation of the vascular system, and the inflammation occurs because these infections cause that inflammation. So it can be very serious. In fact, my father had one of these infections, not the type that we found in...
Hold that thought for just a minute, please. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess. This is Dr. Garth Nicholson. And he was just simply saying that his father had one of these infections, not necessarily the mycoplasma, but there are a number of different infections that people carry today that actually can cause chronic disease, and doctors don't recognize them because they do not produce the normal symptoms, blood work, other things. And unless you're aware that how all of these things can play, whether it be Lyme disease or chlamydia or mycoplasma, or what are some of the others that that can actually create this vasculitis that creates the thrombuses that create the heart attack?
Well, we mentioned chlamydia, pneumonia, various species of mycoplasma, including Mycoplasma fermentans, Mycoplasma pneumoniae, Mycoplasma hominis, Mycoplasma penetrans, Brucella, which is often found in rural areas, and it's known to be for example, carried in various herd animals like cattle and sheep, for example. And then there's a whole new disease that evolved fairly recently, kind of a similar story to our own, called Lyme disease. And in Lyme disease, there's a spirochete called Borrelia that's the principal pathogen, but turns out it's much more complex than that. And most of these patients, as many as 70% of them, also have mycoplasma as a co-infection, as well as other bacteria, for example, like Ehrlichia, for example, and organisms like Babesia, for example. So Lyme disease is a very complex infectious disease, and we have millions of people now that are infected with Lyme disease. It's spreading all over and has spread all over the United States, and it's cropping up practically in every corner of the U.S. now, where it, as it started a few years back in Old Lyme, Connecticut, which is right across the strait from Plum Island, which was the USDA research laboratory where, in fact, these diseases were being worked on by the Army and by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So a lot of these things that we now feel, they're not there by accident. Or in the case of Plum Island, that may have been an accident. But in the case of the diseases that we found in the veterans, it's not by accident. It's by design.
Let me just point out for our listeners, Plum Island is just across the inlet from Lyme, Connecticut. And, of course, there's an inlet here, and on Plum Island you had a biological warfare research institute, and just across the inlet you had Lyme, Connecticut, where the first cases of Lyme disease were actually discovered. And Lyme disease is a lot more complicated than just the Borrelia, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And there are a number of other co-infections, as I mentioned, besides the spirochete, the Borrelia spirochete. There's mycoplasma. The majority of Lyme patients have mycoplasma infections as well. They also have other infections. They have Ehrlichia bacteria, which are somewhat similar to the mycoplasma, Babesia, Bartonella. These other infections tend to complicate the entire disease process. Of course, they make it a lot more pathogenic and a lot more difficult to treat when you have all these co-infections.
And I think it's important for our listeners to understand. We have well over a million people with Lyme disease. Do we have any idea how many people there are out there in America who are chronically disabled because of this terrible disease?
Well, we actually don't have a real good idea about this, and one of the reasons, I think, is that we're having trouble convincing organizations like the CDC, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, to really get heavily involved in studying this, because there is a true epidemic that's going on. It's a very slow-moving epidemic, and that's why it doesn't alarm people like avian flu virus. But this is nonetheless an epidemic which can kill people and kill them with a chronic illness that is very slowly evolving and progressing. So it can be a horrible death for those people that to get it and progress to the point where it's a lethal disease.
And of course the difficulty is that the average doctor really is sort of it's so hard for him to make the diagnosis because he doesn't have the ability to do all the testing that you do, the sophisticated and complicated tests. Isn't there a real problem with making the diagnosis of Lyme disease?
Well, there's a problem making the diagnosis really of all these different chronic illnesses, because they have more or less non-specific overlapping signs and symptoms, and so and they're chronic in nature, so they don't have very specific types of signs or symptoms that you could say, that's got to be this particular disease.
All right, and then what about the blood test, though? Don't they sometimes throw you off if you don't have the ability to do the PCR and other analyses that you do?
Well, it turns out the tests are quite complex, and because these organisms hide inside the tissues themselves, they're not so readily released into the blood, so blood tests are not always positive.
And, of course, a lot of the times patients don't have all the normal... Do they have leukocytosis and other things be associated with infection?
Some do. Actually, most patients show some abnormality in their white blood cell or leukocyte fraction.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Dr. Garth Nicholson right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Dr. Garth Nicholson. Are you going to be able to stay with us as the rest of the half hour here?
Yes.
Okay, that's wonderful. Okay, well, then, of course, there's so much to go into this whole field of medicine. But as far as this story that you tell in your book, which is really the fact that once you had uncovered what was going on and you began trying to treat the people and you were actually getting many of them cured, you come under tremendous pressure, and there actually were attempts at your life at that time?
Yes, there were. And in fact, that became a very dangerous occupation, not only for my wife and I, but also there are lists going around now of hundreds of microbiologists that were involved in studies that were ancillary or related to biologic war, for example, who have died under mysterious conditions. In fact, we had a person who was studying mycoplasma infections, was on sabbatical at Stanford University from Israel, and he had found that very similar to what we had found, these unusual sequences associated with the mycoplasma, and he was coming down to visit us, and he never made it, and we didn't know what happened to him, and then we found out months later that he died mysteriously on his way to visit us.
And of course, basically, a lot of the original work on mycoplasma was done at Stanford, wasn't it? Under the auspices of the CIA?
Well, some of the early work was done there. Yes, that's true. And that's probably why he went there on sabbatical, because there were researchers there who were experts at studying things like mycoplasma. But, you know, there were more than 120 universities that have been involved since the Cold War in doing covert research on biologic agents. And so this is not an unusual situation.
And, of course, basically, I'm sure you've seen these various reports of the Special Virus Cancer Project. And here, all these projects that are hundreds of millions of dollars given by our intelligence agents to these scientists who didn't want anybody to know what they were doing. Had you heard about that until you began getting into this? I don't think the average scientist has any idea what was really going on.
Well, we'd heard stories, but we didn't really know anything about it until we got involved in it. In fact, we still don't know a lot about it because our story is kind of unique and kind of personal. But we do know that if you have something to say that's important, that often people will come after you, and they came after us.
I think that's so hard for the average person in America to believe that this could really be true. But, of course, Steve Quayle has an excellent website where he lists, I think, well over 130, 140 scientists, biologists who are working in this field, all died in very mysterious circumstances. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Dr. Garth Nicholson. And, of course, if you have a question for Dr. Nicholson, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we're talking about, certainly these experiments that were done, so many of our people with chronic fatigue syndrome, so many of our people with Lyme disease, so many of our people with Gulf War illness have, these chronic mycoplasma infections. Now, why is this mycoplasma so dangerous? In other words, mycoplasma's been around for a long time, but most of them are not pathogenic, are they?
That's true. I mean, there are over 100 known species of mycoplasma, and there are only about a half a dozen that are known to be human pathogens. And for many years, nobody took this little primitive bacteria seriously. They didn't think that it could really cause disease, but they were dead wrong, because these mycoplasma get inside cells where they interfere with the metabolism of the cell. And they also release substances which are mutagenic. That is, they can cause mutations in our cells. So they're very dangerous. In fact, we found in cancer patients, we did a study showing that the patients that progressed very quickly and died very quickly from their cancers were often the patients that were infected with these mycoplasma. So they can be dangerous to somebody that's healthy, but they can be very dangerous to somebody that has cancer.
You've mentioned in the past about some specific lipid substances which seem to help the people with these chronic conditions to recover. What was that about?
Well, that again goes back to some of the changes that occur in the cell when these intracellular infections, whether it's Lyme, Borrelia, Brucella, the mycoplasma, and so on. When they get inside the cells, they release substances which oxidize the membranes. And the membranes in our cells that are particularly sensitive are the mitochondrial membranes. Well, it turns out the mitochondria are the little batteries inside our cells that provide the energy for our cells to survive and do the things that they're supposed to do. And, for example, in the central nervous system, the cells are the most active cells in our body in terms of requiring energy. And so if these infections get in there and get in the cells, they can destroy the mitochondria and cause all kinds of havoc. And so this is why we think that people that have these infections have all these cognitive problems. They have brain fog, short-term memory loss, often other problems, severe headaches, all kinds of different neurologic problems. So we think that the metabolism plays a role in this. And so we figured out, well, if the membranes were being damaged and oxidized, what could we do to repair them? And it turns out we naturally do this. It takes time, but we naturally do this if we have the right lipids to repair the membrane, because these membrane, the damaged part of the membrane, are actually the lipids. So we've been working with some of the small nutraceutical companies that make natural formulations that will help repair the mitochondria. And the one that we've been working with the most, in fact, we're going to do a study with the U.S. Navy SEALs operating at high altitude in Afghanistan. That's how important these products are. The one product called Propex
has... How do you spell that?
P-R-O-P-A-X. And there's a website for that, www.propex.com. And that will tell you all about it if you go to that website and the clinical trials that we've done on this product. This is something that helps repair the membranes, particularly the mitochondrial membranes. And so we've done some clinical trials on chronic fatigue patients, for example, and fibromyalgia syndrome patients. And we found that these patients have lost about half of their mitochondrial function. So they're unable to produce the energy, and that's one reason why they're fatigued all the time. So within 60 days of being on this product, we could repair the membranes, and all of a sudden we could cut the fatigue about 30 to 40% in these patients. And so there was a dramatic change in some patients that were highly fatigued. And so this is one of the products that we're recommending in the treatment. We have to treat the infection, but we also have to repair the damage that the infections cause. And so this is one of the important aspects of that.
Well, as far as for treating the infections, is it ordinarily intravenous antibiotics? Is it oral antibiotics? And how do you go about treating the infections?
Well, a lot of it depends on the patient. And different patients have different needs. They have different infections. Most of the patients that have been sick for some time and are very sick have multiple infections. So this has to be juggled a bit, the types of antibiotics or antivirals, because some of them also have viral infections, have to be tailored for the individual patient. But in general terms, there are some antibiotics which can be used. But here's where we run into problems with the established medical regimens for treating bacterial infections. Those don't work with these slow-growing intracellular infections. Long-term treatment seems to be required, and this is something that flies in the face of the CDC and the AMA and the other organizations, which tell people that if they overuse antibiotics, then they'll make the infection resistant and lead to further problems. But that's not what we find at all. We find that these infections require long-term treatment, or it's just not effective. And it's the short-term treatments that are causing the problems, not the long-term treatments.
All right. Somebody had just called in and asked anything about the use of salt in the treatment of Lyme disease. Have you ever heard anything about the use of salt to treat it?
No.
All right, fine. Well, I never had either. So whoever was calling in, there's your answer. Neither one of us. Of course, Dr. Nicholson knows a lot more about this than I do, because I'm this. Even when I was practicing medicine, this was way out of my field. Anyway, of course, the thing is, we have people who, you know, have chronic infections and, of course, long-term antibiotics. But first of all, you have to go to a doctor that, you know, knows how to make the diagnosis. And this, I think, is the problem that we get into with a lot of the people, is they can't find anybody who really believes this. So much of the medical literature tends to poo-poo this, say that it doesn't exist. There is no Gulf War illness, that people with Lyme disease, most of them are somehow psychologically impaired anyway. How can the average individual who's listening to this program, who has these chronic infections, where can they get help today?
Well, this is a problem, but the first stop should be at the patient support groups. And they can go online and just put in the various disease and type in patient support. And they'll find these groups. And when you find these groups, you find people that often have been to 50, 60 physicians and their illnesses, and they know who the bad ones are and who the good ones are. And they pass that information around, and they pass it around willingly. There's some organizations, for example, in the area of rheumatoid arthritis, there's an organization called the Road Back Foundation, and they've been supplying people with information for a long time about infections like mycoplasma and how to treat them. So there are some organizations around that can help, and people just have to find them.
Well, the thing is that I can remember, this is the mid-1970s when I was teaching in Africa at a medical school there, and reading articles at that time, that there were some rheumatologists who felt that the basis of rheumatoid arthritis was a chronic mycoplasma infection, and they were treating it with antibiotics at that time. But most rheumatologists, of course, are convinced that this is not the factor.
Well, the problem is it may not be the factor in 100% of patients, and so this is the problem. We find, for example, mycoplasma infections in a little over half the patients with rheumatoid arthritis, so obviously it's not a factor in all patients. Now, we don't know what the other half might have. They in some cases, they have other chronic infections, and so we now know that there are a whole bunch of these different infections that can cause similar types of diseases. And this becomes a problem. Now, also, these infections often are cofactors in the disease. They may not cause the disease itself, but they cause an exacerbation or a worsening of the signs and symptoms associated with the disease. So there you have another problem as well. And then you have the cases where multiple infections, like Lyme disease, get together and cause a unique clinical spectrum of signs and symptoms. So this always complicates the issue. Making a diagnosis of these chronic illnesses is not easy, because, as I mentioned before, there are no specific signs and symptoms to work on. And then getting the laboratory work done is a real nightmare for most physicians, because they're locked into sending, for example, blood samples to a given laboratory, and most laboratories can't test for these unusual infections because it requires advanced molecular techniques, highly complex techniques like polymerase chain reaction, or PCR, to actually find these infections. And so not everybody is equipped to do this, and there are just a very small number of laboratories in the U.S. that could actually do these tests.
Well, of course, another thing is, of course, building up the patient's own immune system, isn't it, so that they can actually handle the chronic infections?
Well, that's part of what we recommend, and is part of the treatment strategy, is number one, hit the infection directly with antibiotics, or if viruses are involved, antivirals. And then, on the other hand, you have to repair the damage that's been done, and we use lipid replacement therapy to repair membranes, for example, and other supplements to help repair some of the other components of the cells that are damaged, and then build back the immune system. And there are a number of different natural products that are available that actually help in doing this.
Well, do you have those listed on your website?
Yes, in fact, anybody can send me an email, and I'll be glad to send them instructions. Everything from diet to vitamins and minerals to lipid replacement therapy to a number of other things that are useful in terms of the treatment of chronic illnesses.
What about your website? Is that still up, the immed.com?
Yes, it is. It was down for a week because, frankly, in all the rush, we'd forgotten to re-register the domain, and so the domain lapsed for a couple of days, and so the website was down, I think, for 3 or 4 days, but it's back up now. And it's the Institute for Molecular Medicine, www.immed.org. It's like immediate.org. That's how you can remember it.
All right. Now, if somebody wanted to reach you for that email you offered, how would they reach you?
They just go on the website and look under staff and go to my name, and there's an email address there that they can contact me.
All right, fine. And this is Dr. Garth Nicholson, and certainly he has worked for a great period of time. Are you still doing any of the editorial or editing of those scientific journals you were doing before?
I'm still involved in some of them. For example, some of the biochemistry journals and some of the cancer journals and so on. I've tried to let some of that go because at one point I was on more than a dozen journals at once, and it was very time-consuming.
And, of course, for our listeners, why, Dr. Nicholson, last time I checked, you had over 500 and some odd peer-reviewed articles in the literature. How many do you have now?
Well, it's getting close to 600 now.
Right. Well, when we first got started, it was, I think, about 400, but that's been a number of years that I've been interviewing Dr. Nicholson and following his career. And, of course, you really want to get his book, Project Daylily, to find out what happens to a scientist who uncovers things he's not supposed to uncover, the cause of so much chronic disease in America. And certainly, you've written this book sort of as a faction, haven't you?
Well, it's based on a true story. We fictionalized it, that is, we changed the names and changed the places and the institutional names, basically because we didn't want the book held up or tied up in court with frivolous lawsuits, because we've seen that happen before. But basically, everything in there is true, and we even put some of our congressional testimony in the back of the book to show that. So, for example, there's a testimony that I gave to the Committee on Veterans Affairs of the U.S. House of Representatives in the back of the book. So people can check that against what they read in the book.
All right, of course, now as far as the Gulf War illness, has the government ever come out and admitted that this is a real illness, that this is not imaginary?
Well, they've sort of been forced to agree that there's something there, but they haven't really directly come out and done that. And their response in the VA system has been to close down the Gulf War referral centers and to try and pretend that the problem has gone away. But it hasn't gone away. In fact, we're having veterans come back from the second Gulf War with similar types of problems. Maybe not at the same incidence rate, because remember, we have 150,000, 200,000 from the first Gulf War. But nonetheless, they're coming down with these, and some of these are tied to the vaccines, the military vaccines, which some of which are very dangerous. Others are tied to environmental exposures in Iraq and Afghanistan. So we're not talking about trivial problems. We're talking about very complex illnesses that, in some cases, are life-threatening.
And, of course, at least the figures I've read, about 30% of the patients coming back from the current war are having problems after a couple of months, and that's a devastating number. I mean, these are otherwise normal, healthy people. They go overseas to fight for freedom, and they come home, and many of them are chronically ill.
And they're trying to do the same thing with the Gulf War II veterans that they did with the first Gulf War, and that is say that they're all psychological, it's all post-traumatic stress disorder, and that's just not true. We've tested some of the people that have come back, and we've found some of the same problems that we found with the first Gulf War.
In other words, are you finding mycoplasma in them, or what are you finding in them?
Yeah, we're finding all sorts of infections, and, you know, one of the problems is that they're using the same vaccines in many cases that they used in the first Gulf War, and we know that these vaccines are not good. In fact, there are publications on our website that people can download. These are peer-reviewed publications in good journals, just specifically about the vaccines and the problems associated with the vaccines, which there are many. And yet they're just repeating history, doing the same thing all over again.
I think there's not what they call insanity, when you do the same thing over and over again and you expect to get a different result. But, of course, we're talking about the lives of these young men.
Well, the sad part about it is that when you delve deeper into this, you find that there's some very high-level people that are making profits off of these vaccines, and so they're not about to stop them. And I mean high-level. These are people, for example, that were formerly members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the U.S. Armed Forces, are people that were former people in very high executive positions in the U.S. government that are making profit on this.
Well, do you think that the adjuvants that they use in there, for our listeners, that the adjuvant is something you put in a vaccine to make it more effective, do you think that plays any part in this? Because one time they were using something called squalene. Is that a factor, or do you think that's sort of a red herring?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily a red herring. That's certainly a warning sign. That type of adjuvant is only used in experimental vaccines. It's not approved for vaccine general use in vaccines, and it's generally only found in experimental vaccines, and it's a telltale sign that they were using experimental vaccines. in the Gulf War, when they find the presence of, for example, squalene or antibodies against the squalene.
And, of course, the tragedy is they use our military people for just as guinea pigs, and they have no say about it. Isn't that the case?
They have absolutely no say about it whatsoever. And believe me, I've talked to a lot of the military personnel, from the corpsmen and the medics and so on, that went over and had to give the inoculations and so on. We're never told what they were. In fact, they were told that the shot records have to be kept confidential. In fact, they've classified the shot records from the first Gulf War, so nobody can go back and find exactly what they were inoculated with. And I find that that's not only highly unusual, it's never been done in any other war.
And I think it's so important to realize that there are people who are experimenting on our young men and damaging them for life. And nobody is ever punished. Have you ever noticed it doesn't seem to matter what it is? Nobody is ever punished. We have 9-1-1 out of 3,000 Americans dead. Nobody's punished. Nobody's fired. And nobody's condemned. It just happens. And now we see this with the health of our people. We saw it with the prisons. You know, and the use of experimental products in our prisons, spreading them into the guards, but all this story is told in this excellent book, Project Daylily. You want to get it, you want to read it. I couldn't put it down. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Garth Nicholson. We're talking about his book, Project Daylily, a fascinating insight into what happened when Dr. Nicholson and his wife, Dr. Nancy Nicholson, actually began to uncover the fact that there had been all sorts of experiments that had been used, and of course, it was not only in the prisoners, but of course, certainly, they were using experimental and dangerous vaccines on our veterans that came back from the first Gulf War, and so many of them were ill. Now, what about the part that depleted uranium? Do you think this plays any part at all in what we call Gulf War illness?
Well, I think it may play a role in frontline combat units that were exposed, for example, to Iraqi armored vehicles that were killed by depleted uranium munitions. But it certainly doesn't play a role in the overwhelming majority of cases, because they were nowhere near the front lines or near areas of engagement that involved depleted uranium weapons. So, for example, we have a lot of the veterans that served on ships in the Persian Gulf, or that served behind the lines in the quartermaster supply and command and control and other areas where they weren't directly exposed to depleted uranium, and they came down sick and they had these other problems. So that certainly adds on a different problem with the frontline units that were exposed, but I think the majority of people that have Gulf War illness were nowhere near those areas.
And so this would tend to suggest more that it was involving the vaccines that were given to them.
Well, there are several studies now that point to the vaccines. That is, these are epidemiologic studies, so they just simply ask the simple question, are the forces that are deployed that came back sick, were they vaccinated or not? And what happened to people, for example, who were vaccinated and not deployed because the war ended too soon? Or were there people that were sent over that because of time constraints or whatever, for one reason or another, who weren't vaccinated? What happened to them? And from all of this data that they've accumulated, they've looked at this very carefully and find that the vaccines are what has related not deployment, not where you were, but what vaccines you received.
And
that's the relationship with the illness.
And wasn't it that the French didn't take the vaccines and they didn't get the Gulf War illness?
Well, that's true. The French forces do not use vaccines. The vaccines were given, for the most part, to counter biological warfare agents that we thought they might encounter. Of course, they didn't encounter any. But the French forces used another strategy. They used prophylactic antibiotics, for example, to counter bacterial biological warfare agents, and so they didn't have the problems. There are only a very small number of French Armed Forces personnel that came down with Gulf War illness.
We're out of time, Dr. Nicholson. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll look forward to having you with us again.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk about Project Daylily.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest has been Dr. Garth Nicholson and his book, Project Daylily. If you'd like to get it, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. I will tell you, I've read the book. I got one of the original drafts of this before it was actually ever put into a hardcover book, and I couldn't put it down. I think you'll find the same experience. It's a great thriller. It's an exciting book, and it has so much knowledge in there, information on so many subjects. And of course, Dr. Nicholson and his wife are fascinating people. They're outstanding scientists. They're known worldwide. And you're not going to hear this story from Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or so many of the establishment people, that we have. So if you'd like to get Project A. Lilly, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. It's really one of the books that moves most rapidly that we offer. Of course, we have so many other books. If you haven't read Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get a copy. You need to read it. You need, of course, to read the Ted Flynn's book, Hope of the Wicked, which takes you into the occult organizations that are out there. We have a great new 4-tape set on finances called The Financial Armageddon. And ladies and gentlemen, we are in real trouble financially. We've got a great new syllabus and talk on the financial tsunami. You want to get the information, you want to have it available, and you want to make preparations, because I very much fear that so many people in our country are not making preparations for the financial tsunami that is about to sweep across America, destroying everything in its way. So you need to make preparations for the difficult times that lay ahead, and you need to understand the degree of evil that's out there. That's why my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, is so important. And certainly why Ted Flynn's book, which goes into the same material, is so important. And why the videos we have entitled The Secret, I should say the DVD, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, we recommend. That's The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. The DVD and or videos, Megiddo 1, Megiddo 2, they will give you the history of certainly of the background of what's going on today. And starting with the Garden of Eden and bring it right up today, and this impact of the spiritual forces on what is unfolding. So that's Megiddo 1. Megiddo 2, if you'd like to get into what's happening with the music that your children or grandchildren are watching, you need to get They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. That's the 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour version. They're available on both video and DVD now, and you'll never look at the world through the same eyes again after you've seen them. Again, the book, Project A. Lily by Dr. Garth Nicholson. My book, Brotherhood of Darkness. The DVD or video by the same title. Ted Flynn's book, The Hope of the Wicked, and does an excellent job of taking us into the background of the secret societies. And then, of course, to understand what happened when America was founded, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, a 3-hour gripping program that you won't be able to turn off. And it's available only in DVD at the present time. Hopefully we'll have it later on in video, but it will give you an understanding of the two forces that were at work when America was founded, and why, of course, we're moving into Iraq today. And, of course, pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival for our leaders and for our ministers, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we ask you to go to our website at radioliberty.com. You can pull down our website at radioliberty.com. You can listen to our programs directly or indirectly on the Internet 5 hours a day. You can get our shortwave frequencies there. You can get links to our satellites, and we're on a number of satellites. We hope many of you will join the Radio Liberty family and help us as we reach out across America 5 hours a day, trying to teach people about the spiritual battle we're involved in, a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.